4-foot string, tossed it in the air, and sent two squawking birds wheeling off. "Till death do them part!" The whole back of the boat and most of the people in it were dappled with red and silver. Some of us took our shirts off and dipped them over the side and tried to clean them. We fiddled around this way, fishing a little, drinking the other case of beer, and feeding the birds till afternoon, while the boat rolled lazily around the swells and the doctor worked with his monster from the deep. A wind came up and broke the sea into green and silver chunks, like a field of glass and chrome, and the boat began to rock and pitch about more. George told the doctor he'd have to land his fish or cut it loose because there was a bad sky coming down on us. The doctor didn't answer. He just heaved harder on the pole, bent forward and reeled the slack, and heaved again. Billy and the girl had climbed around to the bow and were talking and looking down in the water. Billy hollered that he saw something, and we all rushed to that side, and a shape, broad and white, was becoming solid some 10 or 15 feet down. It was strange watching it rise, first just a light coloring, then a white form like fog underwater, becoming solid, alive.
"Jesus God!" Scanlon cried. "That's the doc's fish!"
It was on the side opposite the doctor, but we could see by the direction of his line that it led to the shape under the water.
"We'll never get it in the boat," Seafelt said. "And the wind's getting stronger." "He's a big flounder," George said. "Sometimes they weigh 200, 300. You got to lift them in with the winch." "We'll have to cut them loose, Doc," Seafelt said, and put his arm across the doctor's shoulders.
The doctor didn't say anything. He had sweated clear through his suit between his shoulders, and his eyes were bright red from going so long without glasses. He kept heaving until the fish appeared on his side of the boat. We watched it near the surface for a few minutes longer, then started getting the rope and gaff ready. Even with the gaff in it, it took another hour to drag the fish into the back of the boat. We had to hook him with all three other poles, and McMurphy leaned down and got a hand in his gills, and with a heave he slid in, transparent white and flat, and flopped down to the bottom of the boat with the doctor.
"That was something,"
the doctor panted from the floor, not enough strength left to push the huge fish off him.
"That was certainly something."
The boat pitched and cracked all the way back to shore, with McMurphy telling grim tales about shipwrecks and sharks. The waves got bigger as we got closer to shore, and from the crests, clots of white foam blew, swirling up in the wind to join the gulls. The swells at the mouth of the jetty were combing higher than the boat, and George had us all put on life jackets. I noticed all the other sports boats were in. We were three jackets short, and there was a fuss as to who'd be the three that braved that bar without jackets. It finally turned out to be Billy Bibbit and Harding and George, who wouldn't wear one anyway on account of the dirt. Everybody was kind of surprised that Billy had volunteered, took his life jacket off right away when we found we were short, and helped the girl into it. But everybody was even more surprised that McMurphy hadn't insisted that he be one of the heroes. All during the fuss, he'd stood with his back against the cabin, bracing against the pitch of the boat, and watched the guys without saying a word, just grinning and watching. We hit the bar and dropped into a canyon of water, the bow of the boat pointing up the hissing crest of the wave going before us, and the rear down in the trough in the shadow of the wave looming behind us, and everybody in the back hanging on the rail and looking from the mountain that chased behind to the streaming black rocks of the jetty 40 feet to the left, to George at the wheel. He stood there like a mast. He kept turning his head from the front to the back, gunning the throttle, easing off, gunning again, holding us steady, riding the uphill slant of that wave in front. He'd told us before we started the run that if we went over that crest in front, we'd surfboard out of control as soon as the prop and rudder broke water, and if we slowed down to where that wave behind caught up, it would break over the stern and dump 10 tons of water into the boat. Nobody joked or said anything funny about the way he kept turning his head back and forth, like it was mounted up there on a swivel. Inside the mooring, the water calmed to a choppy surface again, and at our dock by the bait shop, we could see the captain waiting, with two cops, at the water's edge. All the loafers were gathered behind them. George headed at them full throttle, booming down on them till the captain went to waving and yelling and the cops headed up the steps with the loafers. Just before the prow of the boat tore out the whole dock, George swung the wheel, threw the prop into reverse, and with a powerful roar, snuggled the boat in against the rubber tires like he was easing it into bed. We were already out tying up by the time our wake caught up. It pitched all the boats around and slopped over the dock and white-capped around the docks like we'd brought the sea home with us. The captain and the cops and the loafers came tromping back down the steps to us. The doctor carried the fight to them by first off telling the cops they didn't have any jurisdiction over us, as we were a legal, government-sponsored expedition, and if there was anyone to take the matter up with, it would have to be a federal agency. Also, there might be some investigation into the number of life jackets that the boat held if the captain really planned to make trouble. Wasn't there supposed to be a life jacket for every man on board, according to the law? When the captain didn't say anything, the cops took some names and left, mumbling and confused. And as soon as they were off the pier, McMurphy and the captain went to arguing and shoving each other around. McMurphy was drunk enough he was still trying to rock with the roll of the boat, and he slipped on the wet wood and fell in the ocean twice before he got his footing sufficient to hit the captain one up alongside his bald head and settle the fuss. Everybody felt better that that was out of the way, and the captain and McMurphy both went to the bait shop to get more beer, while the rest of us worked at hauling our fish out of the hold. The loafers stood on that upper dock, watching and smoking pipes they'd carved themselves. We were waiting for them to say something about the girl again, hoping for it to tell the truth. But when one of them finally did say something, it wasn't about the girl, but about our fish, being the biggest halibut he'd ever seen brought in on the Oregon coast. All the rest nodded that that was sure the truth. They came edging down to look it over. They asked George where he learned to dock a boat that way, and we found out George had not just run fishing boats, but he'd also been a captain of a PT boat in the Pacific and got the Navy Cross.
"Should have gone into public office," one of the loafers said. "Too dirty," George told him.
They could sense the change that most of us were only suspecting. These weren't the same bunch of weaknees from a nut house that they'd watched take their insults on the dock this morning. They didn't exactly apologize to the girl for the things they'd said, but when they asked to see the fish she'd caught, they were just as polite as pie. And when McMurphy and the captain came back out of the bait shop, we all shared a beer together before we drove away. It was late when we got back to the hospital. The girl was sleeping against Billy's chest, and when she raised up, his arm had gone dead, holding her all that way in such an awkward position, and she rubbed it for him. He told her if he had any of his weekends free, he'd ask her for a date, and she said she could come to visit in 2 weeks if he'd tell her what time, and Billy looked at McMurphy for an answer. McMurphy put his arms around both of their shoulders and said,
"Let's make it 2 o'clock on the nose."
"Saturday afternoon?" she asked.
He winked at Billy and squeezed the girl's head in the crook of his arm.
"No, 2 o'clock Saturday night. Slip up and knock on that same window you was at this morning. I'll talk the night aide into letting you in."
She giggled and nodded.
"You damn McMurphy," she said.
Some of the acutes on the ward were still up, standing around the latrine to see if we'd been drowned or not. They watched us march into the hall, blood-speckled, sunburned, stinking of beer and fish, toting our salmon like we were conquering heroes. The doctor asked if they'd like to come out and look at his halibut in the back of his car, and we all started back out except McMurphy. He said he guessed he was pretty shot and thought he'd hit the hay. When he was gone, one of the acutes who hadn't made the trip asked how come McMurphy looked so beat and worn out, where the rest of us looked red-cheeked and still full of excitement. Harding passed it off as nothing more than the loss of his suntan.
"You'll recall McMurphy came in full steam from a rigorous life outdoors on a work farm, ruddy of face and abloom with physical health. We've simply been witness to the fading of his magnificent psychopathic suntan, that's all. Today he did spend some exhausting hours in the dimness of the boat cabin, incidentally, while we were out in the elements soaking up the vitamin D. Of course, that may have exhausted him to some extent, those rigors down below, but think of it, friends. As for myself, I believe I could have done with a little less vitamin D and a little more of his kind of exhaustion, especially with little Candy as a taskmaster. Am I wrong?"
I didn't say so, but I was wondering if maybe he wasn't wrong. I'd noticed McMurphy's exhaustion earlier on the trip home, after he'd insisted on driving past the place where he'd lived once. We'd just shared the last beer and slung the empty can out the window at a stop sign and were just leaning back to get the feel of the day, swimming in that kind of tasty drowsiness that comes over you after a day of going hard at something you enjoy doing, half sunburned and half drunk and keeping awake only because you wanted to savor the taste as long as you could. I noticed vaguely that I was getting so's I could see some good in the life around me. McMurphy was teaching me. I was feeling better than I'd remembered feeling since I was a kid, when everything was good, and the land was still singing kids' poetry to me. We drove back inland instead of the coast, to go through this town McMurphy'd lived in the most he'd ever lived in one place, down the face of the Cascade Hill, thinking we were lost, till we came to a town, covered a space about twice the size of the hospital ground. A gritty wind had blown out the sun on the street where he stopped. He parked in some reeds and pointed across the road.
"There, that's the one. Looks like it's propped up out of the weeds. My misspent youth's humble abode."
Out along the dim 6 o'clock street, I saw leafless trees standing, striking the sidewalk there like wooden lightning, concrete split apart where they hit, all in a fenced-in ring. An iron line of pickets stuck out of the ground along the front of a tangleweed yard, and on back was a big frame house with a porch, leaning a rickety shoulder hard into the wind, so as not to be sent tumbling away a couple of blocks like an empty cardboard grocery box. The wind was blowing a few drops of rain, and I saw the house had its eyes clenched shut, and locks at the door banged on a chain. And on the porch, hanging, was one of those things that Japs make out of glass and hang on strings. Rings and clangs and the least little blow, with only 4 pieces of glass left to go. These 4 swung and whipped and wrung little chips off on the wooden porch floor. McMurphy put the car back in gear.
"Once I've been here, since way the hell gone back in the year we were all getting home from that Korea mess, for a visit. My old man and old lady were still alive. It was a good home."
He let out the clutch and started to drive, then stopped instead.
"My God," he said. "Look over there. See a dress?" He pointed out back. "And the branch of that tree? A rag? Yellow and black?"
I was able to see a thing like a flag, flapping high in the branches over a shed.
"The first girl ever drugged me to bed wore that very same dress. I was about 10, and she was probably less. And at the time, a lay seemed like such a big deal, I asked her if didn't she think, feel, we ought to announce it in some way. Like, say, tell our folks, 'Mom, Judy and me got engaged today.' And I meant what I said. I was that big a fool. I thought if you made it, man, you were legally wed right there on the spot, whether it was something you wanted or not, and that there wasn't any breaking the rule. But this little whore, at the most 8 or 9, reached down and got her dress off the floor and said it was mine. Said, 'You can hang this up someplace. I'll go home in my drawers, announce it that way. They'll get the idea.' Jesus, 9 years old, he said, reached over and pinched Candy's nose, and knew a lot more than a good many pros." She bit his hand, laughing, and he studied the mark. "So anyhow, after she went home in her pants, I waited till dark when I had the chance to throw that damn dress out in the night. But you feel that wind. Caught the dress like a kite and whipped it around the house out of sight. And the next morning, by God, it was hung up in that tree for the whole town, was how I figured then to turn out and see."
He sucked his hand, so woebegone that Candy laughed and gave it a kiss. "So my colors were flown, and from that day to this, it seemed I might as well live up to my name. Dedicated lover. And it's the God's truth. That little 9-year-old kid out of my youth, the one to blame." The house drifted past. He yawned and winked. "Taught me to love. Bless her sweet ass." Then, as he was talking, a set of taillights going past lit up McMurphy's face, and the windshield reflected an expression that was allowed only because he'd figured it to be too dark for anybody in the car to see. Dreadfully tired and strained and frantic, like there wasn't enough time left for something he had to do. While his relaxed, good-natured voice doled out his life for us to live, a rollicking past full of kid fun and drinking buddies and loving women and barroom battles over meager honors for all of us to dream ourselves into. Part 4. The big nurse had her next maneuver underway the day after the fishing trip. The idea had come to her when she was talking to McMurphy the day before about how much money he was making off the fishing trip and other little enterprises along that line. She had worked the idea over that night looking at it from every direction this time until she was dead sure it could not fail. And all the next day she fed hints around to start a rumor and have it breeding good before she actually said anything about it. She knew that people, being like they are, sooner or later are going to draw back a ways from somebody who seems to be giving a little more than ordinary, from Santa Clauses and missionaries and men donating funds to worthy causes, and begin to wonder, what's in it for them? Grin out of the side of their mouths when the young lawyer, say, brings a sack of pecans to the kids in his district school, just before nominations for the state senate, the sly devil, and say to one another, he's nobody's fool. She knew it wouldn't take too much time to get the guys to wondering just what it was, now that you mention it, that made McMurphy spend so much time and energy organizing fishing trips to the coast and arranging bingo parties and coaching basketball teams. What pushed him to keep up a full head of steam when everybody else on the ward had always been content to drift along playing pinochle and reading last year's magazines? How come this one guy, this Irish rowdy from a work farm where he'd been serving time for gambling and battery, would loop a kerchief around his head, coo like a teenager, and spend 2 solid hours having every acute on the ward hurrahing him while he played the girl trying to teach Billy Bibbit to dance? Or how come a seasoned con like this, an old pro, a carnival artist, a dedicated odds watcher gambling man, would risk doubling his stay in the nut house by making more and more an enemy out of the woman who had the say-so as to who got discharged and who didn't? The nurse got the wondering started by pasting up a statement of the patient's financial doings over the last few months. It must have taken her hours of work digging into records. It showed a steady drain out of the funds of all the acutes, except one. His funds had risen since the day he came in. The acutes took to joking with McMurphy about how it looked like he was taking them down the line, and he was never one to deny it. Not the least bit. In fact, he bragged that if he stayed on at this hospital a year or so, he just might be discharged out of it into financial independence, retire to Florida for the rest of his life. They all laughed about that when he was around, but when he was off the ward at ET or OT or PT, or when he was in the nurse's station getting bawled out about something, matching her fixed plastic smile with his big ornery grin, they weren't exactly laughing. They began asking one another why he'd been such a busy bee lately, hustling things for the patients, like getting the rule lifted that the men had to be together in therapeutic groups of 8 whenever they went somewhere. "Billy here has been talking about slicing his wrists again," he said in a meeting when he was arguing against the group of 8 rule. "So is there 7 of you guys who'd like to join him and make it therapeutic?" And like the way he maneuvered the doctor, who was much closer to the patient since the fishing trip, into ordering subscriptions to Playboy and Nugget and Man, and getting rid of all the old McCalls that bloated-faced public relation had been bringing from home and leaving in a pile on the ward, articles he thought we might be particularly interested in checked with green ink. McMurphy even had a petition in the mail to somebody back in Washington, asking that they look into the lobotomies and electroshock that were still going on in government hospitals. "I just wonder," the guys were beginning to ask, "what's in it for old Mac?" After the thought had been going around the ward a week or so, the big nurse tried to make her play in group meeting. The first time she tried, McMurphy was there at the meeting, and he beat her before she got good and started. She started by telling the group that she was shocked and dismayed by the pathetic state the ward had allowed itself to fall into. "Look around, for heaven's sakes, actual pornography clipped from those smut books and pinned on the walls." She was planning, incidentally, to see to it that the main building made an investigation of the dirt that had been brought into this hospital. She sat back in her chair, getting ready to go on and point out who was to blame and why, sitting on that couple of seconds of silence that followed her threat like sitting on a throne, when McMurphy broke her spell into whoops of laughter by telling her to be sure now and remind the main building to bring their little hand mirrors when they came for the investigation. So the next time she made her play, she made sure he wasn't at the meeting. He had a long-distance phone call from Portland and was down in the phone lobby with one of the black boys waiting for the party to call again. When 1 o'clock came around and we went to moving things, getting the day room ready, the least black boy asked if she wanted him to go down and get McMurphy in Washington for the meeting, but she said no. It was all right. Let him stay. Besides, some of the men here might like a chance to discuss our Mr. Randall Patrick McMurphy in the absence of his dominating presence. They started the meeting telling funny stories about him and what he'd done, and talked for a while about what a great guy he was, and she kept still, waiting till they all talked this out of their systems. Then the other questions started coming up. What about McMurphy? What made him go on like he was, do the things he did? Some of the guys wondered if maybe the tale of him faking fights at the work farm to get him sent here wasn't just more of his spoofing, and that maybe he was crazier than people thought. The big nurse smiled at this and raised her hand. "Crazy like a fox," she said. "I believe that is what you're trying to say about Mr. McMurphy."
"What do you mean?" Billy asked.
McMurphy was his special friend and hero, and he wasn't too sure he was pleased with the way she'd laced that compliment with things she didn't say out loud.
"What do you mean,
like a fox?" "It's a simple observation, Billy," the nurse answered pleasantly. "Let's see if some of the other men could tell you what it means. What about you, Mr. Scanlon?"
"She means, Billy, that Mac's nobody's fool."
"Nobody said he was.
Billy hit the arm of his chair with his fist to get out the last word.
"But Miss Ratchet was implying."
"No, Billy, I wasn't implying anything. I was simply observing that Mr. McMurphy isn't one to run a risk without a reason. You would agree to that, wouldn't you? Wouldn't all of you agree to that?" Nobody said anything. "And yet," she went on, "he seems to do things without thinking of himself at all, as if he were a martyr or a saint. Would anyone venture that Mr. McMurphy was a saint?" She knew she was safe to smile around the room, waiting for an answer. "No, not a saint or a martyr. Here, shall we examine a cross-section of this man's philanthropy?" She took a sheet of yellow paper out of her basket. "Look at some of these gifts, as devoted fans of his might call them. First, there was the gift of the tub room. Was that actually his to give? Did he lose anything by acquiring it as a gambling casino? On the other hand, how much do you suppose he made in the short time he was croupier of his little Monte Carlo here on the ward? How much did you lose, Bruce? Mr. Seafelt? Mr. Scanlon? I think you all have some idea what your personal losses were, but do you know what his total winnings came to, according to deposits he has made at funds? Almost $300. Scanlon gave a low whistle, but no one else said anything. "I have various other bets he made listed here, if any of you care to look, including something to do with deliberately trying to upset the staff. And all of this gambling is completely against ward policy, and every one of you who dealt with him knew it." She looked at the paper again, then put it back in the basket. "And this recent fishing trip? What do you suppose Mr. McMurphy's profit was on this venture? As I see it, he was provided with a car of the doctor's, even with money from the doctor for gasoline, and, I am told, quite a few other benefits, without having paid a nickel. Quite like a fox, I must say." She held up her hand to stop Billy from interrupting. "Please, Billy, understand me. I'm not criticizing this sort of activity as such. I just thought it would be better if we didn't have any delusions about the man's motives. But, at any rate, perhaps it isn't fair to make these accusations without the presence of the man we are speaking of. Let's return to the problem we were discussing yesterday. What was it?" She went leafing through her basket. "What was it? Do you remember, Dr. Spivey?" The doctor's head jerked up.
No, I think...
She pulled a paper from a folder. "Here it is, Mr. Scanlon. His feelings about explosives. Fine, we'll go into that now, and at some other time when Mr. McMurphy is present, we'll return to him. I do think, however, that you might give what was said today some thought. Now, Mr. Scanlon?" Later that day, there were 8 or 10 of us grouped together at the canteen door, waiting till the black boy was finished shoplifting hair oil, and some of the guys brought it up again. They said they didn't agree with what the big nurse had been saying, but hell, the old girl had some good points. And yet, damn it, Mac's still a good guy. Really. Harding finally brought the conversation into the open. "My friends, thou protest too much to believe the protesting.
You are all believing deep inside your stingy little hearts that our Miss Angel of Mercy Ratchet is absolutely correct in every assumption she made today about McMurphy. You know she was, and so do I. But why deny it? Let's be honest and give this man his due instead of secretly criticizing his capitalistic talent. What's wrong with him making a little profit? We've all certainly got our money's worth every time he's fleeced us, haven't we? He's a shrewd character with an eye out for a quick dollar. He doesn't make any pretense about his motives, does he? Why should we? He has a healthy and honest attitude about his chicanery, and I'm all for him. Just as I'm for the dear old capitalistic system of free individual enterprise, comrades, for him and his downright bull-headed gall and the American flag, bless it, and the Lincoln Memorial and the whole bit. Remember the Maine, P.T. Barnum, and the 4th of July. I feel compelled to defend my friend's honor as a good old red, white, and blue 100% American con man. Good guy, my foot. McMurphy would be embarrassed to absolute tears if he were aware of some of the Simon Pure motives people had been claiming were behind some of his dealings. He would take it as a direct effrontery to his craft. He dipped into his pocket for cigarettes. When he couldn't find any, he borrowed one from Fredrickson, lit it with a stagey sweep of his match, and went on. I'll admit, I was confused by his actions at first. That window breaking? Lord, I thought, here's a man that seems to actually want to stay in this hospital, stick with his buddies and all that sort of thing, until I realized that McMurphy was doing it because he didn't want to lose a good thing. He's making the most of his time in here. Don't ever be misled by his backwoodsy ways. He's a very sharp operator, level-headed as they come. You watch. Everything he's done was done with reason. Billy wasn't about to give in so easy.
Yeah? What about him teaching me to dance?
He was clenching his fists at his side, and on the backs of his hands I saw that the cigarette burns had all but healed, and in their place were tattoos he'd drawn by licking an indelible pencil.
What about that, Harding? Where is he making money out of teaching me to dance?
Don't get upset, William, Harding said, but don't get impatient either. Let's just sit easy and wait and see how he works it. It seemed like Billy and I were the only two left who believed in McMurphy, and that very night, Billy swung over to Harding's way of looking at things when McMurphy came back from making another phone call and told Billy that the date with Candy was on for certain and added, writing an address down for him, that it might be a good idea to send her a little bread for the trip.
Bread? Money? How much?
He looked over to where Harding was grinning at him.
Oh, you know, man, maybe 10 bucks for her and 20 bucks? It doesn't cost that much for bus fare down here.
McMurphy looked up from under his hat brim, gave Billy a slow grin, then rubbed his throat with his hand, running out a dusty tongue.
Boy, oh boy, I'm terrible dry. Figure to be even drier by a week come Saturday. You wouldn't begrudge her bringing me a little swallow, would you, Billy boy?
And gave Billy such an innocent look, Billy had to laugh and shake his head no, and go off to a corner to excitedly talk over the next Saturday's plans with the man he probably considered a pimp. I still had my own notions, how McMurphy was a giant, come out of the sky to save us from the combine that was networking the land with copper wire and crystal, how he was too big to be bothered with something as measly as money, but even I came halfway to thinking like the others. What happened was this. He'd helped carry the tables into the tub room before one of the group meetings and was looking at me standing beside the control panel.
By God, Chief, he said. It appears to me you growed 10 inches since that fishing trip. And Lord almighty, look at the size of that foot of yours. Big as a flat car.
I looked down and saw how my foot was bigger than I'd ever remembered it, like McMurphy's just saying it had blowed it twice its size.
And that arm, that's the arm of an ex-football playing Indian if I ever saw one. You know what I think? I think you ought to give this here panel a little heft, just to test how you're coming.
I shook my head and told him no, but he said we'd made a deal, and I was obligated to give it a try to see how his growth system was working. I didn't see any way out of it,
so I went to the panel just to show him I couldn't do it. I bent down and took it by the levers.
That's the baby, Chief. Now just straighten up. Get those legs under your butt there. Yeah, yeah. Easy now. Just straighten up. Woo-wee! Now ease her back to the deck.
I thought he'd be real disappointed, but when I stepped back, he was all grins and pointing to where the panel was off its mooring by half a foot. Better set her back where she came from, buddy, so nobody will know. Mustn't let anybody know yet.
Then after the meeting, loafing around the pinochle games, he worked the talk around to strength and gut power and to the control panel in the tub room. I thought he was going to tell them how he'd help me get my size back. That would prove he didn't do everything for money. But he didn't mention me. He talked until Harding asked him if he was ready to have another try at lifting it, and he said no. But just because he couldn't lift it was no sign it couldn't be done. Scanlon said maybe it could be done with a crane, but no man could lift that thing by himself, and McMurphy nodded and said maybe so, but you never can tell about such things. I watched the way he played them, got them to come around to him and say, no, by Jesus, not a man alive could lift it, finally even suggest the bet themselves. I watched how reluctant he looked to bet. He let the odds stack up, suck them in deeper and deeper, till he had 5-1 on a sure thing from every man of them, some of them betting up to $20. He never said a thing about seeing me lifted already. All night I hoped he wouldn't go through with it, and during the meeting the next day, when the nurse said all the men who participated in the fishing trip would have to take special showers because they were suspected of vermin, I kept hoping she'd fix it somehow, make us take our showers right away or something, anything to keep me from having to lift it. But when the meeting was over, he led me and the rest of the guys into the tub room before the black boys could lock it up and had me take the panel by the levers and lift. I didn't want to, but I couldn't help it. I felt like I'd helped him cheat them out of their money. They were all friendly with him as they paid their bets, but I knew how they were feeling inside, how something had been kicked out from under them. As soon as I got the panel back in place, I ran out of the tub room without even looking at McMurphy and went into the latrine. I wanted to be by myself. I caught a look at myself in the mirror. He'd done what he said. My arms were big again, big as they were back in high school, back at the village. And my chest and shoulders were broad and hard. I was standing there looking when he came in. He held out a $5 bill.
Here you go, Chief. Chewing gum money.
I shook my head and started to walk out of the latrine. He caught me by the arm.
Chief, I just offered you a token of my appreciation. If you figure you got a bigger cut coming...
No, keep your money. I won't have it.
He stepped back and put his thumbs in his pockets and tipped his head up at me. He looked me over for a while.
Okay, he said. Now what's the story? What's everybody in this place giving me the cold nose about?
I didn't answer him.
Didn't I do what I said I would? Make you man-sized again? What's wrong with me around here all of a sudden? You birds act like I'm a traitor to my country.
You're always winning things.
Winning things? You damn moose, what are you accusing me of? All I do is hold up my end of the deal. Now what's so all fired?
We thought it wasn't to be winning things.
I could feel my chin jerking up and down the way it does before I start crying, but I didn't start crying. I stood there in front of him with my chin jerking. He opened his mouth to say something and then stopped. He took his thumbs out of his pockets and reached up and grabbed the bridge of his nose between his thumb and finger, like you see people do whose glasses are too tight between the lenses, and he closed his eyes.
Winning, for Christ's sakes,
he said with his eyes closed.
Ooh, boy. Winning.
So I figured what happened in the shower room that afternoon was more my fault than anybody else's, and that's why the only way I could make any kind of amends was by doing what I did, without thinking about being cagey or safe or what would happen to me, and not worrying about anything else for once but the thing that needed to be done and the doing of it. Just after we left the latrine, the three black boys came around, gathering the bunch of us for our special shower. The least black boy scrambling along the baseboard with a black, crooked hand cold as a crowbar, prying guys loose leaning there, said it was what the big nurse called a cautionary cleansing. In view of the company we'd had on our trip, we should get cleaned before we spread anything through the rest of the hospital.
We lined up nude against the tile, and here one black boy came, a black plastic tube in his hand, squirting a stinking salve, thick and sticky as egg white. In the hair first, then turn around and bend over and spread your cheeks. The guys complained and kidded and joked about it, trying not to look at one another or those floating slate masks working down the line behind the tubes like nightmare faces in negative, sighting down soft, squeezy nightmare gun barrels. They kidded the black boys by saying things like, "Hey, Washington, what do you fellas do for fun the other 16 hours?
Hey, Williams, can you tell me what I had for breakfast?"
Everybody laughed. The black boys clenched their jaws and didn't answer. This wasn't the way things used to be before that damned redhead came around. When Fredrickson spread his cheeks, there was such a sound I thought the least black boy would be blown clear off his feet.
"Hark," Harding said, cupping his hand to his ear. "The lovely voice of an angel."
Everyone was roaring and laughing and kidding one another until the black boy moved on and stopped in front of the next man. And the room was suddenly absolutely quiet. The next man was George. And in that one second, with the laughing and kidding and complaining stopped, with Fredrickson there next to George straightening up and turning around, and a big black boy about to ask George to lean his head down for a squirt of that stinking salve, right at that time all of us had a good idea about everything that was going to happen and why it had to happen and why we'd all been wrong about McMurphy. George never used soap when he showered. He wouldn't even let somebody hand him a towel to dry himself with. The black boys on the evening shift who supervised the usual Tuesday and Thursday evening showers had learned it was easier to leave it go like this, and they didn't force him to do any different. That was the way it had been for a long time. All the black boys knew it, but now everybody knew, even George, leaning backward, shaking his head, covering himself with big oak leaf hands, that this black boy, with his nose busted and his insides soured and his two buddies standing behind him waiting to see what he would do, couldn't afford to pass up the chance.
Bend your head down here, George.
The guys were already looking to where McMurphy stood a couple of men down the line.
Come on, George.
Martini and Seafelt were standing in the shower, not moving. The drain at their feet kept choking short little gulps of air and soapy water. George looked at the drain a second, as if it were speaking to him. He watched it gurgle and choke. He looked back at the tube in the black hand before him, slow mucus running out of the little hole at the top of the tube down over the pig iron knuckles. The black boy moved the tube forward a few inches, and George listed farther back, shaking his head.
"No, none that stuff!"
"You're gonna have to do it, Rub-a-Dub,"
the black boy said, sounding almost sorry.
"You're gonna have to. We can't have the place crawling with bugs now, can we? For all I know, you got bugs on you a good inch deep."
"No,"
George said.
"Ah, George, you just don't have no idea. These bugs, they very, very teeny. No bigger than a pinpoint. And man, what they do is get you by the short hair and hang on and drill down inside you, George."
"No bugs," George said.
"Oh, let me tell you, George, I've seen cases where these awful bugs actually..."
"Okay, Washington,"
McMurphy said. The scar where the black boy's nose had been broken was a twist of neon. The black boy knew who'd spoken to him, but he didn't turn around. The only way we knew he'd even heard was by the way he stopped talking and reached up a long gray finger and drew it across the scar he'd gotten that basketball game. He rubbed his nose a second, then shoved his hand out in front of George's face, scrabbling the fingers around.
"A crab, George, see? See here. Now you know what a crab look like, don't you? Sure, now you get crabs on that fishing boat. We can't have crabs drilling down into you, can we, George?"
"No crabs!"
George yelled.
"No!"
He stood straight and his brow lifted enough so we could see his eyes. The black boy stepped back a ways. The other two laughed at him.
"Something the matter, Washington, my man?"
the big one asked.
"Something holding up this end of the procedure, my man?"
He stepped back in close.
"George, I'm telling you, bend down. You either bend down and take this stuff or I lay my hand on you."
He held it up again. It was as big and black as a swamp.
"Put this black, filthy, stinking hand all over you."
"No hand,"
George said, and lifted a fist above his head as if he would crash the slate's skull to bits, splatter cogs and nuts and bolts all over the floor. But the black boy just ran the tube up against George's belly button and squeezed, and George doubled over with a suck of air. The black boy squirted a load in his wispy white hair, then rubbed it in with his hand, smearing black from his hand all over George's head. George wrapped both arms around his belly and screamed, "No! No!"
"Now turn around, George."
"I said that's enough, buddy." This time the way his voice sounded made the black boy turn and face him. I saw the black boy was smiling, looking at McMurphy's nakedness. No hat or boots or pockets to hook his thumbs into. The black boy grinned up and down him.
"McMurphy," he said, shaking his head. "You know, I was beginning to think we might never get down to it."
"You goddamn coon," McMurphy said, somehow sounding more tired than mad. The black boy didn't say anything. McMurphy raised his voice.
"Goddamned motherfucking nigger."
The black boy shook his head and giggled at his two buddies.
"What do you think Mr. McMurphy's driving at with that kind of talk, man? You think he wants me to take the initiative? Don't he know we train to take such awful sounding insults from these crazies? Cocksucker. Washington, you're nothing but a..."
Washington had turned his back on him, turning to George again. George was still bent over, gasping from the blow of that salve in his belly. The black boy grabbed his arm and swung him facing the wall.
"That's right, George. Now spread those cheeks."
"No! Oh, oh, oh."
"Washington," McMurphy said. He took a deep breath and stepped across to the black boy, shoving him away from George.
"Washington, all right? All right?"
Everybody could hear the helpless, cornered despair in McMurphy's voice.
"McMurphy, you forcing me to protect myself? Ain't he forcing me, man?"
The other two nodded. He carefully laid down the tube on the bench beside George, came back up with his fist swinging all in the same motion and busting McMurphy across the cheek by surprise. McMurphy nearly fell. He staggered backward in the naked line of men, and the guys caught him and pushed him toward the smiling slate face. He got hit again in the neck before he gave up to the idea that it had started at last, and there wasn't anything now but to get what he could out of it. He caught the next swing black snaking at him and held him by the wrist while he shook his head clear. They swayed a second that way, panting along with the panting drain. Then McMurphy shoved the black boy away and went into a crouch, rolling the big shoulders up to guard his chin, his fists on each side of his head, circling the man in front of him. And that neat, silent line of nude men changed into a yelling circle, limbs and bodies knitting in a ring of flesh. The black arms stabbed in at the lowered red head and bull neck, chipped blood off the brow and the cheek. The black boy danced away, taller, arms longer than McMurphy's thick red arms, punches faster and sharper. He was able to chisel at the shoulders and the head without getting in close. McMurphy kept walking forward, trudging flat-footed steps, face down and squinting up between those tattooed fists on each side of his head, till he got the black boy against the ring of nude men and drove a fist square in the center of the white starched chest. That slate face cracked pink, ran a tongue the color of strawberry ice cream over the lips. He ducked away from McMurphy's tank charge and got in another couple of licks before that fist laid him another good one. The mouth flew open wider this time, a blotch of sick color. McMurphy had red marks on the head and shoulders, but he didn't seem to be hurt. He kept coming, taking 10 blows for one. It kept on this way, back and forth in the shower room, till the black boy was panting and staggering and working mainly at keeping out of the way of those clubbing red arms. The guys were yelling for McMurphy to lay him out. McMurphy didn't act in any hurry. The black boy spun away from a blow on his shoulder and looked quick to where the other two were watching.
"Williams, Warren, damn you!"
The other big one pulled the crowd apart and grabbed McMurphy around the arms from behind. McMurphy shook him off like a bull shaking off a monkey, but he was right back. So I picked him off and threw him in the shower. He was full of tubes. He didn't weigh more than 10 or 15 pounds. The least black boy swung his head from side to side, turned and ran for the door. While I was watching him go, the other one came out of the shower and put a wrestling hold on me, arms up under mine from behind and hands locked behind my neck, and I had to run backward into the shower and mash him against the tile. and while I was lying there in the water trying to watch McMurphy bust some more of Washington's ribs, the one behind me with the wrestling hold went to biting my neck, and I had to break the hold. He laid still then, the starch washing from the uniform down the choking drain. And by the time the least black boy came running back in with straps and cuffs and blankets and four more aides from Disturbed, everybody was getting dressed and shaking my hand and McMurphy's hand and saying they had it coming and what a rip-snorter of a fight it had been, what a tremendous big victory. They kept talking like that to cheer us up and make us feel better about what a fight, what a victory, as the big nurse helped the aides from Disturbed adjust those soft leather cuffs to fit our arms. Up on Disturbed, there's an everlasting high-pitched machine room clatter, a prison mill stamping out license plates, and time is measured out by the didock, didock of a ping-pong table. Men pacing their personal runways get to a wall and dip a shoulder and turn and pace back to another wall, dip a shoulder and turn and back again. Fast short steps, wearing crisscrossing ruts in the tile floor, with a look of caged thirst. There's a singed smell of men scared berserk and out of control, and in the corners and under the ping-pong table, there's things crouched gnashing their teeth that the doctors and nurses can't see and the aides can't kill with disinfectant. When the ward door opened, I smelled that singed smell and heard that gnash of teeth. A tall, bony old guy dangling from a wire screwed in between his shoulder blades met McMurphy and me at the door when the aides brought us in. He looked us over with yellow, scaled eyes and shook his head. "I wash my hands of the whole deal," he told one of the colored aides, and the wire drug him off down the hall. We followed him down to the day room, and McMurphy stopped at the door and spread his feet and tipped his head back to look things over. He tried to put his thumbs in his pockets, but the cuffs were too tight. "It's a scene," he said out of the side of his mouth. I nodded my head. I'd seen it all before. A couple of the guys pacing stopped to look at us, and the old bony man came dragging by again, washing his hands of the whole deal. Nobody paid us much mind at first. The aides went off to the nurse's station, leaving us standing in the day room door. McMurphy's eye was puffed to give him a steady wink, and I could tell it hurt his lips to grin. He raised his cuffed hands and stood looking at the clatter of movement and took a deep breath.
"McMurphy's the name, partners," he said in his drawling cowboy actor's voice. "And the thing I want to know is, who's the peckerwood runs the poker game in this establishment?"
The ping-pong clock died down in a rapid ticking on the floor.
"I don't deal blackjack so good hobbled like this, but I maintain I'm a fire eater in a stud game."
He yawned, hitched a shoulder, bent down and cleared his throat, and spat something at a waste paper can 5 feet away. It rattled in with a ting, and he straightened up again, grinned, and licked his tongue at the bloody gap in his teeth.
"Had a run-in downstairs. Me and the chief here locked horns with two grease monkeys."
All the stamp mill racket had stopped by this time, and everybody was looking toward the two of us at the door. McMurphy drew eyes to him like a sideshow barker. Beside him, I found that I was obliged to be looked at too, and with people staring at me, I felt I had to stand up straight and tall as I could. That made my back hurt where I'd fallen in the shower with the black boy on me, but I didn't let on. One hungry looker with a head of shaggy black hair came up and held his hand like he figured I had something for him. I tried to ignore him, but he kept running around in front of whichever way I turned like a little kid, holding that empty hand cupped out to me. McMurphy talked a while about the fight, and my back got to hurting more and more. I'd hunkered in my chair in the corner for so long that it was hard to stand straight very long. I was glad when a little Jap nurse came to take us into the nurse's station, and I got a chance to sit and rest. She asked if we were calm enough for her to take off the cuffs, and McMurphy nodded. He had slumped over with his head hung and his elbows between his knees and looked completely exhausted. It hadn't occurred to me that it was just as hard for him to stand straight as it was for me. The nurse, about as big as the small end of nothing whittled to a fine point, as McMurphy put it later, undid our cuffs and gave McMurphy a cigarette and gave me a stick of gum. She said she remembered that I chewed gum. I didn't remember her at all. McMurphy smoked while she dipped her little handful of pink birthday candles into a jar of salve and worked over his cuts, flinching every time he flinched and telling him she was sorry. She picked up one of his hands in both of hers and turned it over and salved his knuckles. "Who was it?" she asked, looking at the knuckles. "Was it Washington or Warren?" McMurphy looked up at her. "Washington," he said, and grinned. "The chief here took care of Warren." She put his hand down and turned to me. I could see the little bird bones in her face. "Are you hurt anywhere?" I shook my head. "What about Warren and Williams?" McMurphy told her he thought they might be sporting some plaster the next time she saw them. She nodded and looked at her feet. "It's not all like her ward," she said. "A lot of it is, but not all. Army nurses trying to run an army hospital. They are a little sick themselves. I sometimes think all single nurses should be fired after they reach 35. "At least all the single army nurses," McMurphy added. He asked how long we could expect to have the pleasure of her hospitality. "Not very long, I'm afraid."
"Not very long, you're afraid?" McMurphy asked her.
"Yes. I'd like to keep men here sometimes instead of sending them back, but she has seniority. No, you probably won't be very long, I mean, like you are now. The beds undisturbed are all out of tune, too taut or too loose. We were assigned beds next to each other. They didn't tie a sheet across me, though they left a little dim light on near the bed. Halfway through the night, somebody screamed,
"I'm starting to spin, Indian! Look me! Look me!"
I opened my eyes and saw a set of long yellow teeth glowing right in front of my face. It was the hungry-looking guy.
"I'm starting to spin! Please look me!"
The aides got him from behind, two of them, dragged him laughing and yelling out of the dorm,
"I'm starting to spin, Indian!"
Then just laugh. He kept saying it and laughing all the way down the hall till the dorm was quiet again, and I could hear that one other guy saying,
"Well, I wash my hands of the whole deal." "You had a buddy for a second there, Chief,"
McMurphy whispered and rolled over to sleep. I couldn't sleep much the rest of the night, and I kept seeing those yellow teeth and that guy's hungry face asking to look me, look me. Or finally, as I did get to sleep, just asking. That face, just a yellow starved need come looming out of the dark in front of me, wanting things, asking things. I wondered how McMurphy slept, plagued by 100 faces like that, or 200, or 1,000. They've got an alarm on disturbed to wake the patients. They don't just turn on the lights like downstairs. This alarm sounds like a gigantic pencil sharpener grinding up something awful. McMurphy and I both sat bolt upright when we heard it, and we were about to lie back down when a loudspeaker called for the two of us to come to the nurse's station. I got out of bed, and my back had stiffened up overnight to where I could just barely bend. I could tell by the way McMurphy gimped around that he was as stiff as I was.
"What they got on the program for us now, Chief?" he asked. "The boot? The rack?
I hope nothing too strenuous because, man, am I stove up bad." I told him it wasn't strenuous, but I didn't tell him anything else, because I wasn't sure myself till I got to the nurse's station, and the nurse, a different one, said, "Mr. McMurphy and Mr. Bromden," then handed us each a little paper cup. I looked in mine, and there are three of those red capsules. This sing whirs in my head, and I can't stop.
"Hold on," McMurphy says. "These are those knockout pills, aren't they?"
The nurse nods, twists her head to check behind her. There's two guys waiting with ice tongs, hunching forward with their elbows linked. McMurphy hands back the cup, says,
"No, sir, ma'am, but I'll forego the blindfold. Could use a cigarette, though."
I hand mine back, too, and she says she must phone, and she slips the glass door across between us, is at the phone before anybody can say anything else.
"I'm sorry if I got you into something, Chief," McMurphy says,
and I can barely hear him over the noise of the phone wires whistling in the walls. I can feel the scared downhill rush of thoughts in my head. We're sitting in the day room, those faces around us in a circle, when in the door comes the big nurse herself, the two big black boys on each side, a step behind her. I try to shrink down in my chair, away from her, but it's too late. Too many people looking at me. Sticky eyes hold me where I sit. "Good morning," she says. Got her old smile back now. McMurphy says good morning, and I keep quiet even though she says good morning to me, too, out loud. I'm watching the black boys. One has tape on his nose and his arm in a sling, gray hand dribbling out of the cloth like a drowned spider, and the other one is moving like he's got some kind of cast around his ribs. They're both grinning a little. Probably could have stayed home with their hurts, but wouldn't miss this for nothing. I grin back just to show them. The big nurse talks to McMurphy, soft and patient, about the irresponsible thing he did, the childish thing, throwing a tantrum like a little boy. "Aren't you ashamed?" He says he guesses not and tells her to get on with it. She talks to him about how they, the patients downstairs in our ward, at a special group meeting yesterday afternoon, agreed with the staff that it might be beneficial that he receive some shock therapy, unless he realizes his mistakes. All he has to do is admit he's wrong, to indicate, to demonstrate rational contact, and the treatment would be canceled this time. That circle of faces waits and watches. The nurse says it's up to him.
"Yeah?"
he says.
"You got a paper I can sign?"
"Well, no, but if you feel it necessary..."
"And why don't you add some other things while you're at it and get them out of the way? Things like, oh, me being part of a plot to overthrow the government, and like how I think life on your ward is the sweetest goddamn life this side of Hawaii, you know, that sort of crap."
"I don't believe that would..."
"Then, after I sign, you bring me a blanket and a package of Red Cross cigarettes." "Hoo-wee, those Chinese commies could have learned a few things from you, lady."
"Randall, we are trying to help you." But he's on his feet, scratching at his belly, walking on past her and the black boys rearing back toward the card tables.
"Okay, well, 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 where's this poker table, buddies?"
The nurse stares after him a moment, then walks into the nurse's station to use the phone. Two colored aides and a white aide with curly blonde hair walk us over to the main building. McMurphy talks with the white aide on the way over, just like he isn't worried about a thing. There's frost thick on the grass, and the two colored aides in front trail puffs of breath like locomotives. The sun wedges apart some of the clouds and lights up the frost till the grounds are scattered with sparks. Sparrows fluffed out against the cold, scratching among the sparks for seeds. We cut across the crackling grass past the digger squirrel holes where I saw the dog. Cold sparks. Frost down the holes, clear out of sight. I feel that frost in my belly. We get up to that door, and there's a sound behind like bees stirred up. Two men in front of us reeling under the red capsules, one bawling like a baby, saying,
"It's my cross. Thank you, Lord. It's all I got. Thank you, Lord."
The other guy waiting is saying,
"Guts ball, guts ball."
He's the lifeguard from the pool, and he's crying a little too. I won't cry or yell, not with McMurphy here. The technician asks us to take off our shoes, and McMurphy asks him if we get our pants slit and our head shaved too. The technician says no such luck. The metal door looks out with its rivet eyes. The door opens, sucks the first man inside. The lifeguard won't budge. A beam like neon smoke comes out of the black panel in the room, fastens on his cleat-marked forehead, and drags him in like a dog on a leash. The beam spins him around three times before the door closes, and his face is scrambled fear.
"Hut one," he grunts. "Hut two. Hut three."
I hear them in there pry up his forehead like a manhole cover, clash and snarl of jammed cogs. Smoke blows the door open, and a gurney comes out with the first man on it, and he rakes me with his eyes. That face. The gurney goes back in and brings the lifeguard out. I can hear the yell leaders spelling out his name. The technician says, "Next group." The floor's cold, frosted, crackling. Up above, the light winds, tube long and white and icy. Can smell the graphite salve, like the smell in a garage. Can smell acid of fear. There's one window up high, small, and outside I see those puffy sparrows strung up on a wire like brown beads, their heads sunk in the feathers against the cold. Something goes to blowing wind over my hollow bones, higher and higher, air raid,
air raid. Don't holler, Chief. Air raid. Take her easy. I'll go first. My skull's too thick for them to hurt me. And if they can't hurt me, they can't hurt you. Climbs on the table without any help and spreads his arms out to fit the shadow. A switch snaps the